You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin group is creating collections of books to help families talk about diversity, race, and social inequality. We'll find out more about how it works and where to find a kit. First, oral arguments for another federal legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act were heard today. It's a case that could have big implications for the law and for this year's midterm elections. The suit is brought by 20 Republican attorneys general and governors from across the country, including Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here.
We've got all these Republican attorneys general. What's the case they're making here? What's the grounds for the challenge to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, what they are arguing is that last December, when Congress passed the tax bill, it repealed the penalty for not having insurance. It didn't repeal the requirement for not having insurance, but it lowered the penalty to zero. The reason they did that was the only way they could do it. But what the Republican attorneys general are arguing is that without that tax penalty, the rest of the law is now unconstitutional because, as they point out, the Supreme Court in 2012 kind of hung the constitutionality of the law on the existence of Congress using its taxing power. And therefore, they say without the tax, there is no more law.
And in the short run, the Republican attorneys general say, hey, judge, let's have a preliminary injunction. Now, what happens if the judge grants that?
That's right. So basically, they're saying, while this case is being litigated, we should put the entire Affordable Care Act on ice. That seems unlikely. Even if this judge, who's a pretty conservative judge, were to do that, that could be appealed immediately on an emergency basis, you know, up the line. And it seems unlikely that, you know, even that the Supreme Court would say, let's pause the entire health law while we argue about this.
Right. If something like that were to happen, and it sounds like you say that's unlikely, but what would that mean for healthcare providers, customers, people in the marketplace, exchanges?
Oh, it would be a giant mess. This affects everything. It's not just people who are on the exchanges and people who are buying their individual coverage through the Affordable Care Act. There this affects Medicare and Medicaid and people with employer-provided insurance. Remember, the Affordable Care Act was a huge, huge law. So it would basically, you know, bring the entire national healthcare system to a screeching halt.
Now, on the other side, we've got Republicans, attorneys general from a number of states, including Wisconsin. This is being defended not as a federal law by the Department of Justice, but by Democratic attorneys general from other states. Why is that happening?
Well, that's because the Department of Justice, in a very unusual move, decided that it didn't disagree entirely with the plaintiffs. And, of course, the Department of Justice are the defendants in this case. What Justice said is that we don't think the whole law is now unconstitutional, but we think that a couple of pieces of the law, and those are the pieces that protect people with pre-existing conditions, they say, well, without the tax penalty, we think those things might be unconstitutional. So they sort of agree and sort of disagree. And so the Democratic attorneys general came in and said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. These are pieces of this law that are really important to us as states, so we're going to intervene to defend the entire law against this lawsuit. And the judge said, okay. So you've basically got sort of three players here. You've got the Republican attorneys general, the Democratic attorneys general, and the Justice Department in the middle.
What are the Democrats defending the law saying? What's the basis of their argument?
Well, their argument is that this is not a very strong legal argument to make about the law. And in fact, they have on their side a number of constitutional lawyers who actually disagreed on previous lawsuits about the Affordable Care Act. So, but they agree that this lawsuit does not have a whole lot of legal merit. And, of course, the Democratic attorneys general have standing because their states get so much money and their insurance systems are so important, you know, have been affected in such important ways by the Affordable Care Act.
Now, you said the preliminary injunction, again, doesn't seem likely, but what are likely outcomes of this case? Where would it go after this judge rules?
Well, they very much chose this venue because this is a very conservative judge. So there's some thought that this judge could agree with them. Then it would go, you know, up to the next level, up to the appeals court level, and possibly up to the Supreme Court, depending on who wants to appeal and what happens. So, you know, that's why the Kavanaugh hearings that are going on today are sort of kind of linked to this, because these are the arguments about particularly the pre-existing condition protections, whether those might be at stake in this lawsuit. And indeed, they could be.
Talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News about the latest big lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Oral arguments going on today. Julie, you've been watching what Congress is doing and how they're watching this case. What are you seeing?
That's right. The number of Republicans in the Senate came out with a bill last week that said, well, even if this got struck down, the pre-existing condition protections got struck down in the courts, they wanted to have this bill that would put them in a different part of law. The problem with that, as they pointed out, is that while the bill that the Republicans introduced last week would require insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions, it wouldn't require them to cover the pre-existing conditions. We saw this a lot prior to the Affordable Care Act, where people who were sort of sent to high-risk pools because they had some kind of disease would go and they could get coverage, but that disease might not be covered. Or it might not be covered for a year. And that's sort of what the Republicans are talking about now. Or that's what their bill would do. They say that that was not their intent, but that is what the bill that they've introduced would do. It turns out to be very difficult to do this outside the broader framework.
This is, of course, a midterm election year. Midterm election is just a couple months off. I'll say even today I'm seeing emails from the Democrats saying, hey, this is something people should be worried about, that Republican attorney general in Wisconsin is doing, the Republican governor, candidate for Senate. Are you seeing this as something that could influence elections?
Oh, absolutely. This is, you know, the Democrats are looking at this as something of a gift because it enables them to say that, you know, here are Republicans arguing for something that would take away protections for people who already have illnesses. Those are by far the most popular part of the Affordable Care Act. We know that the Republicans also think that's important because they tried to introduce a bill that would take care of it. So we know that this is something where the Democrats feel like they have a very sort of firm point of attack against the Republicans. On the other hand, Republicans, you know, it's a midterm election. They're trying to gin up their base. So if they can come out and say, look, you know, we didn't get to repeal the Affordable Care Act, you know, in Congress last year, but here's a lawsuit that might be able to make it go away. So they can sort of, you know, turn out their base too. So both sides are sort of using this as a political cudgel, if you will.
I don't know if this is something people are keeping an eye on out there in Washington, but Senator John McCain, the late Senator John McCain, was a key no vote in that effort to overturn the Affordable Care Act. Well, now his interim replacement has been appointed. Might be a yes vote. Could there be another effort in Congress to repeal and or replace the Affordable Care Act?
There could be, but the Republicans still don't have the votes because, remember, in the interim between when McCain did that and now, the Alabama seat turned from Republican to Democrat. So they would still be short a vote, even with, you know, former Senator John Kyle, an opponent of the Affordable Care Act, taking McCain's place. They still don't have the votes, but they are certainly saying that, you know, if they keep control of the House and Senate, that there will be another effort next year.
Let's take this back to Texas before we're done. When do we anticipate a ruling from this judge?
Not entirely clear. It seems unlikely today, but possibly in the next week or two. I mean, they want an injunction. This is not the merits of the case. So generally, those requests are acted on in a relatively short period of time, at least as federal courts go.
Julie, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
My pleasure.
That was Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News, talking to us about a federal lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Oral arguments in that case took place today in a federal district court in Texas. According to data from UW-Madison's Cooperative Children's Book Center, 31% of children's books published in 2017 featured diverse characters. That's the highest percentage since 1994, which means books featuring characters of color are becoming more readily available. The creators of an Eau Claire-based program say that Wisconsin families can benefit from reading more of these diverse books. The group says it can be an approachable way to have important conversations about race and equity with kids and be a great learning lesson for grown-ups, too. Becky Linderholm is an educator, social justice advocate, and co-creator of Family Conversation Kits, a resource designed to help families begin important lifelong conversations about diversity and equity. Becky, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take us through the basics, Becky. What is in these conversation kits? What do they do?
Yeah, so the kits are comprised of usually 2 to 3 different books and then a guide that we write to go along with those books. And we currently make them available to families all over the community through the public libraries and things like that. We've received donations and grants in order to do this free of charge. And the guides kind of give families some good background information about the groups that the kits focus on and provide some questions for parents and children to discuss together that connect to the specific books we've chosen for the kit.
And what was the inspiration to try to do this?
Well, we were the people in our group were part of a community engagement initiative called Circles of Change that happened in this area. And our task was to, by the end of our kind of group project or our meeting times, to come up with action steps that we could take in our area to make our area more welcoming and accepting and inclusive. And so this was, it started as an idea of let's make sure that the libraries in our area, school libraries, public libraries, and beyond are purchasing and featuring and highlighting diverse books by diverse authors. And then it kind of morphed into, that's great if we have them, but a lot of families want to be having these conversations and feel just kind of that they don't have the right information or they're afraid they might say the wrong thing. And so let's also help families with how to start these conversations.
Right. These can be tough conversations, maybe easier not had than had. What kind of things are you hoping come out of these kits when families bring them home?
Well, we hope that families leave with, I guess, the background information to feel confident knowing that they're using vocabulary words that are appropriate for the groups that the kits focus on. And also just to know there's a whole section in our guides that talk about frequently asked questions like if your child's in the grocery store and they point out someone of a different race, how could you handle that situation? So that families know instead of going, shh, 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 we don't talk about that, how can you kind of help your child to have that conversation and know that it's okay to notice race and it's not racist to notice race? It's important to notice that people are different. And when we start to notice differences, then our eyes are more open to the different ways people experience the world because of those differences. And then we can pave the way for more equitable communities.
You launched these kits at different locations through the summer. What kind of feedback are you getting so far?
So far, people are really excited that they are there. We've heard from parents and educators so far that have been saying they've learned so much from the kits and they feel more confident in having these conversations. And they are glad that we've kind of, I guess, taken, kind of selected some of the best books for them to use to start these conversations as well. So they know where to start.
What age range of kids is this targeted for?
So we have each kit focuses on a specific topic. So our first kits that we released are focusing on Asians and the Latinx community. And then within each topic, we have different editions of the kits. So there is an early childhood kit, a young readers kit, which would be pretty much early to middle elementary school, and then a tweens and teens kit, which would be upper elementary and middle school age kids. And so the books are chosen. We have an Asian early childhood young readers and tweens and teens kit, and the books are selected to be age appropriate for those young people.
Now, is this something you had seen done anywhere else, or did you kind of invent something new here as far as you know?
Well, actually, we had read about an organization in St. Louis, I believe, that they actually started having classes for white families to come to begin their conversations about race. And we read that they used a lot of books. And so it was kind of a partnership of that. And then the initial idea of let's make sure that our community has diverse books available to families all over the community.
And now this is in the Eau Claire area. Have you heard from people maybe in other communities in Wisconsin saying, hey, how can we start our own?
We haven't heard from anybody in other parts of Wisconsin yet. And right now, our kits are currently available to just people in our area. But we are working with a bookstore that's in our area called Dotters Books, Dotters. And they're an online bookstore getting a physical space. And they have agreed to help us with our sales and shipping of kits so that people outside of the Chippewa Valley can start to they can purchase kits, or individual families, if they want to, could purchase a kit and have it shipped right to their door. And hopefully that will be ready to go by the holidays.
if somebody's listening, they're not in your part of the state, but they're thinking, yeah, I like the idea of getting my kids some diverse books. Do you have ideas of where they could go to find them?
Absolutely. So the first thing I would suggest is follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So Family Conversation Kits on Facebook or at Family Kits on Twitter. Every Friday, we recommend a new book and we list some ideas of things, conversations that book could spark. But also there are other great resources like We Need Diverse Books is a nonprofit. They have an Our Story app that you can, families can just search by specific group and they'll find all the books listed that kind of connect to that. Social Justice Books is another one. They write great reviews as well. And the blogger Pragmatic Mom has over 60 book lists about different kinds of groups of multicultural books. So she's another person that I follow.
And what are some of the next steps for your program?
Yeah, next steps for us. So we have two topics currently available to families. We're reviewing books right now for our next set of kits, which will focus on the LGBTQIA+ community. And then beyond that, we have a whole list of different identities that we want to hit and help families start conversations about.
And big picture, as we said earlier on, race is sometimes a topic easier not to talk about than to talk about. How would you encourage people to start opening up and having these conversations?
Yeah, I think our guides are really helpful for families if they can get their hands on those, hopefully soon for people all over the state and country. But beyond that, I think, it can be very intimidating for us to start conversations about race. But knowing that there's a lot we don't know is helpful. And being able to say to children and young people in our lives, I don't know the answer to that right now. Let me do some research and get back to you. So I think sometimes as adults, we feel like we have to be able to answer every question. We have to know the answer. And it's really powerful for children to see that sometimes we don't know and we have to talk to people who know better than us, or we have to do a little bit of reading and we're going to do that and get back to you. So I think being humble like that can be very, very helpful. And starting with the books that that you can find on those lists we talked about or on our Facebook and Twitter pages can be a good place to begin as well.
Becky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Becky Linderholm is an educator, social justice advocate, and co-creator of Family Conversation Kits, a resource designed to help families begin lifelong conversations about diversity and equity. For more info about diverse books and to locate one of these kits in your area, if you're in that part of the state, find Family Conversation Kits on Facebook. Health experts are calling it a public health crisis. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 2.3 million cases of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia were diagnosed last year. That broke the 2016 record by about 200,000. Earlier this year, a State Department of Public Instruction survey found that sexually transmitted diseases are on the rise, despite fewer high schoolers saying they're sexually active. So why are STD rates going up, and what could turn those numbers around? Dr. Janina Smith is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. Dr. Smith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This is such an important issue.
When you see these numbers from CDC, rates going up pretty quickly, what do you think? What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's shocking, and it's very important for everyone to be aware. I think those numbers don't even reflect the overall issue, which is that STD rates have been increasing since 2013 at alarming rates.
Is there something that's changed in American culture, society, medicine, I don't know what, that could account for these increases?
So we don't know for sure what's causing the increase, but there are a couple things that we think are contributing. Number one, it's wonderful news that HIV is now a very treatable condition, but there no longer is the same fear of acquiring HIV, and therefore a number of people have become more lax on safer sex practices. For example, condom use has dropped quite considerably. In addition, we think that the role of technology in setting up sexual encounters may be impacting the rates of sexually transmitted infections. Apps such as Tinder and Bumble sometimes allow people to have more frequent unprotected sexual encounters than they might have prior to the technology.
I want to spend a fair amount of time on prevention, but first I want to look at the treatment side of things. For these diseases, what kind of treatment is there? How bad do they get if they're untreated?
Well, that's a very important question because most of the sexually transmitted infections that you're reading about, certainly the three you mentioned, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, those are bacterial infections. And over time, gonorrhea has gotten increasingly resistant. However, within Wisconsin at this time, those are all treated with short courses of routine antibiotics. But whenever someone's at risk for sexually transmitted infection, if you're at risk for one, you're actually at risk for all of them. And things like HIV and herpes produce chronic infection that would be lifelong.
And I think people might think of those bacterial ones that we're focusing on and think, oh, well, I don't want them, but they're easily treatable with antibiotics. Do you think that makes people not take them as seriously because they don't think through the antibiotic resistance issues?
Perhaps that's true. And more to your point previously, there's a variety of effects of not treating those infections that include worsening infections that ascend, go up into the body, infertility, which is a particular concern for ectopic pregnancy for women. And so those are things, reasons why these infections should be treated. Yes, they are treatable at this time with short courses of antibiotics, but they also increase the risk of acquiring HIV because they irritate the regions where HIV is often acquired.
Talking to Dr. Janina Smith from UW Health, looking at recent CDC numbers showing a continuing multi-year rise in a number of sexually transmitted diseases. Dr. Smith, reading up on this information from the CDC, it looks like very often these diseases are transmitted by someone who doesn't yet know they have it. So it's if it's not detected, they might spread it and pass on the disease before they're even aware that it's around.
That's absolutely true. Men are much more likely to have symptoms with gonorrhea and chlamydia, for example. Women may be entirely asymptomatic and it only be detected at their routine screening exams.
And part of the effort to prevent it, a lot of people talk about more testing. How important is that? How are we doing on testing people, especially sexually active people, for these diseases?
I think we can do better. The testing is extremely important because if a patient doesn't have symptoms and they don't know to present to the healthcare provider to be tested and to be treated. And so we need to have a higher index of suspicion in patients who have risk behavior and to go ahead and test and treat because that inhibits the spread as well of the infections.
Is there a stigma related to these diseases that might lead people to not seek out STD testing?
I think that's absolutely true.
Is that something that you think might affect testing numbers at a significant level?
I think it does. It definitely affects testing on a significant level. A lot of people feel like these infections are exceptional and that maybe they brought it on themselves. They don't feel that way if they got a skin infection from a scrape or if they got pneumonia, and they're embarrassed. And they may also not feel comfortable talking to their healthcare providers about the behaviors that put them at risk.
Do we have enough funding for local health efforts at STD prevention, whether we're talking about testing, public outreach, anything like that?
At this time, we're doing very well in Dane County, but there have been recent declines in public health funding, for example, in Milwaukee, which has had a very terrible outbreak of syphilis for a number of years.
Right. Milwaukee reporting about 4,000 cases of gonorrhea last year, unfortunately leading the nation, a cluster. Health officials say of HIV and you mentioned syphilis cases. Do you have any sense of why we'd see an outbreak like that in one particular community?
Syphilis has always, going back many, many years, had a particular frequency in the Milwaukee area. And obviously people tend to find sexual partners in a geographically close area. And so I think that that's probably why it's stuck there. There's also a number of patients who are not receiving treatment. And as I say, cuts in the public health budget certainly don't help the situation.
I want to talk about kind of public outreach and getting the message out, bringing back the messages about condom usage in particular. Without that real life or death issue, as you're talking about, with HIV being front and center, is it possible to get that message out there about the importance of condoms?
I think it is. I think that we just need to make the effort. Condoms are the only birth control that are also prevention for sexually transmitted infection that's effective. And so I think a lot of times patients who may have very effective birth control like an IUD or be using oral contraceptives or be surgically sterilized think that they don't need any protection of any kind with sexual activity. And they're still then at risk for sexually transmitted infection. And I would add that this is also true of older individuals who are no longer at risk from becoming pregnant, women over 50, for example, they're still at risk for acquiring HIV. And actually, a number of the new HIV diagnoses are in that age group.
are there other groups that, that you're particularly watching for to see what's happening with their numbers apart from that age group?
Well, the, as you mentioned, chlamydia is the most common sexually transmitted infection countrywide, and the vast majority of women are asymptomatic, but this can have a very profound impact on fertility in women or complications of pregnancy like ectopic pregnancy. So it is now currently recommended that all women who are sexually active between the ages of 15 and 45 get screened for chlamydia. But I think you're right. A lot of the time, this isn't being done. By the same token, those same patients are candidates for getting HIV screening yearly because early detection and early treatment not only helps prevent the spread of those infections, but also prevents their complications.
I want to key in a little bit on the high school years. We mentioned that survey from the state's Department of Public Instruction, fewer kids reporting that they had sex. This has been going down. That confirms a lot of national surveys. Kids are having sex apparently later, also fewer partners. But STD rates apparently are going up despite that. What do you make of that?
I think that it's hard to explain except for perhaps a decrease in condom use. I'm going to date myself for a moment, but when I was a teenager in high school, every class was about safer sex practices and the risk of HIV. And I think I've talked personally to high school groups who aren't really even aware what HIV is anymore. And so I think a lack of awareness has led to decreased safer sex practices in that group.
Now, can you talk about the means of transmission a little bit? These diseases, are they just transmitted by intercourse, or can things like oral sex transmit some of them as well?
Yeah, absolutely not. They're not transmitted only from contact between genitals, but through any surfaces that like the, that line the mouth and that line the genital surfaces, as well as anal intercourse can transmit all of these infections. So any genital-to-genital contact, genital-to-mouth, genital-to-anus contact can spread these infections.
And is that something you think there's enough awareness of?
No. I absolutely think that a lot of people think that oral sex means safe sex, and that's definitely not true.
We're talking about record high rates of sexually transmitted diseases, three of them in particular, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. Our guest is Dr. Janina Smith, infectious disease specialist for UW Health. And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the surge in STD diagnoses? Have you talked to your kids about the risk? Or if you're a younger person yourself, have parents or teachers, classrooms given you the information you think you need? What questions do you have about the spread of STDs and their treatments? What do you think needs to be done as individuals, as a public health effort by communities to do to turn these numbers around? And what are you seeing in your community? Anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our discussion on growing rates of STD infections and what people can do to keep themselves safe and what communities can do to turn the numbers around. Dr. Janina Smith is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health, and you can join the question at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about STDs and why the numbers are going up? Are you seeing prevention efforts in your community, in your schools? Are you part of those efforts? What kind of things are you doing? Do you have the resources you need? If you're at a school, what kind of education, what kind of sex ed is going on there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Jenny is with us in Neenah. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to make some kind of comments and then maybe a suggestion. I'm Generation X, and I know a lot of younger people. And their mentality, because there is so much information out there now, is, well, everybody has it, so why care? And that's what I've actually been told as a person. This isn't what I think they're thinking. And so because of that, they don't think it's a big deal. They don't get tested, because then if someone comes back to them and says, hey, I know that I got this STD from you because you're the only person I've been with, they can say, oh, well, I didn't know, so you can't be mad at me. Ignorance is bliss, right? So I know a long time ago with my generation, there was a big stigma on having STDs and things like that. Well, I think we've gone way too far the other way to where there's almost no stigma anymore. And so people just don't even think that it's important because everybody's got it. So what's the big deal? So I don't know how we turn that around. I don't feel that it should be stigmatized like it was when I was growing up, but I don't think it should be so unstigmatized that people don't think it's a big deal anymore to get it.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Jenny sees people, Dr. Smith, taking younger people, she says, taking STDs for granted.
Well, I think the important part to focus on in a person who says that it doesn't matter and that they wouldn't want to get tested and treated is that there can be long-term consequences for their own health or the health of their partners who they care about. And so I think the motivating factor there should be you don't want to have infertility down the line. You don't want to have chronic pelvic pain from pelvic inflammatory disease. And that would be a motivation to have them seek treatment.
Jenny, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Kim is with us now in Madison. Kim, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Kim?
Well, I wanted to ask a couple of questions. One of them is, I have a 15-year-old son, and he has some special needs, so I'm sure he's not interested much in speaking about sex ed in junior high or in high school, but I've not gotten any materials from the Madison or the Middleton Unified School District sent home to me talking about what they're learning about in sex ed. I certainly haven't heard anything about them having access to condoms. When I was growing up in Janesville, Wisconsin, you could go in and talk to your guidance counselor and you could get a hold of some free condoms. I really think that there must be some connection between the fact that there's just one Planned Parenthood in Madison and two in Milwaukee. When I was growing up, there were, you know, there were six other Planned Parenthoods throughout Wisconsin, including in Janesville, which I used. And so my concern is that, for one, condoms are very, very expensive, and it's very embarrassing as a teenager to go into a drugstore and buy them. And two, that, you know, are they being is this being discussed on a regular basis, not like once a year for 2 weeks, or, you know, once every couple of years for 2 weeks or whatever. This should be like a, you know, week in, week out, month in, month out, ongoing conversations in our junior highs and high schools. And so I guess my concern is, you know, is this lack of sex ed and access to condoms and access to Planned Parenthoods and other kinds of organizations fueling this situation? I think we want to steer away from blaming teens.
Kim, thanks for the call. Dr. Smith, what do you think?
I think that's a great idea. Education is one of the core principles of health. And without teenagers understanding how sexually transmitted infections are spread, the consequences of untreated sexually transmitted infection, and who to seek for help, it would undeniably be a confusing and difficult situation. There have been funding cuts from my perspective, sadly, education about the health of our bodies may be a controversial topic in terms of education of teenagers, but I think it does place them at risk, and I would agree with you from that perspective. I would offer an additional source for information, which is young people's primary care providers, both pediatricians, family medicine doctors, internal medicine doctors, obviously know a lot about this type of condition. And for Kim, I would encourage her to set up an appointment, perhaps where her son can talk privately with his own doctor, perhaps even without her present, and have his questions answered. And I think that would be one mechanism also to get one-on-one teaching. Because as a physician, we often think of the three T's. So talk to our patients, talk openly about how sexually transmitted infections are acquired, risk factors that they might have as individuals, questions that they have about their sexual health. For patients who are at risk, based on that discussion, we should test, and even testing patients who are asymptomatic. And then finally, those that have positive tests, we should immediately treat. And I think this is a role, it's wonderful the role that Planned Parenthood has played, but primary care physicians are educated about sexually transmitted infections as well and can definitely serve as a resource that's very effective for our young people.
Kim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about a rise in rates of sexually transmitted diseases, Dr. Janina Smith is with us from UW Health. Back to your calls now. Susan is with us in Racine. Susan, hello.
Hi. I want to thank you for this program. It's really important to get that word out there about teens and how sexually active they are. I'm a volunteer sexual educator for teens through my church, and I think it's so important for parents to take an active role in educating their children. If you want them to hear about it on a daily or weekly basis, the best place is at home. You know, I really think that if you start early with your kids, it's not a big deal. I have with my two sons, and, you know, we talk freely about it and about, you know, purchasing condoms. I don't think many teens from the two that I've caught have any embarrassment whatsoever about going into a pharmacy and purchasing them. I just think it's really important that, you know, kids know the dangers. They want to get checked out. I mean, most of the kids in my class, know what can happen if you have an STD, especially for females that goes undiagnosed until you're maybe 18 when they, you know, most parents think that's the time to see a gynecologist.
Susan, thanks for the call. Dr. Smith, Susan talking about not just parents having the talk with kids, but she says have an ongoing conversation with kids over the years, age appropriate from early on through the teen years.
I totally agree with that. I think that if you limit it to a single talk, as opposed to an idea that this is an ongoing dialogue, then as your teen's risk behaviors may change over the teen years or what their activities or interests or what their friends are doing, they'll be much more likely to be open with you, and you'll be able to provide them with information and protect them.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Melissa is with us in Platteville. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Thanks for taking this call. I'm a first-time caller and kind of nervous.
Go for it. You got it.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know I work at a family planning clinic in Platteville, and the caller who called in before about access to condoms, it's important for teens especially, but anybody to know that the family planning clinic network in Wisconsin is very helpful. We can sign people up for family planning only services, or FPOS, which is a benefit of Badger Care, which only takes into consideration the income of the person applying. So, for example, it's only the teen's income and not the family income, or it's only the woman's income and not her entire family income, or the man's as well. We do treat women and men. And there's a great website if people want to check out bedsider.org. That can has lots of information about birth control and STDs. Also,
We have to leave it there, Melissa. Dr. Smith, very briefly, are you hopeful that we can turn this around?
I'm very hopeful that we can turn around, but I think education is the key.
We'll leave it there, Dr. Smith. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Janina Smith is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. We talked with her about record high rates, according to the CDC, of things like syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia in the United States.